Wrongful convictions reversed in Duval more than 40 years later. It's a last bash for the Jacksonville Landing. And a city flood study that doesn't study the neighborhoods that flooded. Some of the stories making headlines this week. Good Friday morning and live from Studio 5. This is First Coast Connect and I'm Melissa Ross. Thanks for listening. Just ahead, all of the biggest stories of the week with our Friday Media Roundtable. You can join us. Give us a call right now. It's 549-2937. Then later, it's a brush with nature this weekend at the Jacksonville Arboretum. We'll tell you about that too. All of that ahead. But first, it's Friday, and here to discuss a very busy news week, we welcome Steve Patterson of the Florida Times-Union. Good morning, Steve.
Good morning. Good to be here.
New to the panel, Lisa Gruba of Florida Field Notes. Hey, Lisa.
Good morning, and happy Friday.
Happy Friday. Our regular contributor and podcast host, Charles Griggs, is here.
Good morning, Melissa.
And rounding out our fabulous foursome blogger, Fred Matthews.
Good morning, Melissa.
Guys, so good to have you all here today, and lots to discuss. It's been a busy news week. Later, we'll talk about a local flood study that honestly seems to be all wet to one last bash for the Jacksonville Landing. That's coming up, too. Plus, some only in Florida for you. All of that ahead. But first this hour, our top story this Friday. The convictions of two Jacksonville men were overturned Thursday after they served more than 40 years behind bars for crimes that the evidence now shows they did not commit. 40 years in prison, two innocent men. Now, the order to vacate the convictions of Clifford Williams and his nephew, Nathan Myers, stems from a recommendation made by Florida's first ever Conviction Integrity Review Unit. This was set up by State Attorney Melissa Nelson last year, and certainly kudos go to her and her office for this action. So we're going to begin the hour with a closer look at the wrongful convictions stemming to 1976 of Jacksonville uncle and nephew Clifford Williams and Nathan Myers. What are your questions and comments about this case? Give us a call. It's 549-2937. That's 549-2937. Or go online. Send your emails to firstcoastconnect@wjct.org. Send your tweets to @MelissaInJax, and we welcome your comments as well on Facebook. And let's begin with you, Charles Griggs. Imagine spending more than 40 years in prison for a crime that you know you didn't commit. These men spent decades trying to get their case reviewed. The new Conviction Integrity Unit set up in this judicial circuit heard their pleas after many, many years, and they are now free. But an incredible miscarriage of justice, at least it appears to be, based on what we know about this case. And it also took the Innocence Project of Florida to help free these two men. Their work was also very important.
Yeah, as this story was unfolding yesterday, I was doing the math in my head, and these men are roughly the same age as my father, which means to me that I would have been 15 years old and losing my dad for 42, almost 43 years of my life. I can't imagine the pain and difficulty a family had to go through over that period of time. Now, the relevant thing here is that we always talk about elections and how elections have consequences. This is one of the things that State Attorney Melissa Nelson campaigned on. She didn't really campaign on a conviction integrity unit per se, but she said that she was going to give voice to the concerns of people who had situations like this. Out of that conversation and out of the support when she got elected, this conviction integrity unit came to be. And from that, you saw an opportunity here for their concerns be heard. A letter came in, and this was one of the first cases that we've seen to go through this process. So you have to give credit to Melissa Nelson for even having such a unit in place to be able to hear those concerns and to give voice to some of those people who feel like they've been wrongly convicted.
Right. They were wrongly convicted, Steve Patterson, on the testimony of a single eyewitness. There was a mountain of evidence that contradicted her testimony that these two men had shot her. But for a number of reasons, the prosecutors ignored that evidence. Let's talk about those reasons.
The reasons are really kind of hard to fathom. It seems that there was a decision made, certainly in the investigation process, to say we fundamentally don't care what a scientist somewhere says. If they had ballistics that said this, these shots came from one weapon, not from two, as the eyewitness said. They had evidence that showed the shots had to have been fired outside the house, not inside the house, which was what the eyewitness said. And I think someone must have simply said, I can't explain this, but I have someone standing in front of me who lived through this. She must be telling the truth.
Yeah. It's 549-2937 to join us. Fred Matthews, this happened in the mid-1970s. We've come a long way in America since then, but still institutional racism, the rush to get a conviction, particularly it appears sometimes if the defendants are of color, these are still issues today. And when I heard about this story, the first thing that came to my mind was there are certainly other people sitting in prison right now who were likely wrongfully convicted years before. They might not have the Innocence Project behind them to help get their cases heard or reheard. There are other cases like this in the system, which is a tragedy.
This is a case in point one as to why over generations, folks just don't trust the criminal justice system. Many people of color won't talk because of this. It does no good, they say. Who cares? And this is a case in which I think all of the people involved, the victim, the person's charge, all of them were of color, but they went into a system that was all white. All white. The lawyers were all white. The judges were all white. You know, everybody's there, and nobody cared enough to look deeper than what they saw. It was a murder. It happened in the hood. Somebody's guilty. One of these guys got a felony anyway. So what difference is it going to make? If we don't get him on this, we'll get him on something else. And they simply didn't look any further than that, even with the fact that, you know, we have witnesses at the time who said the guys weren't there. They couldn't be there. And the evidence said that the bullet didn't come from inside. This was ignored. Where or any place else would that be ignored except during that period of time and earlier when these things happened and there was no one else who cared? But as Charles indicated, elections do have consequences. I don't think that this necessarily would have come to fore, although we have had exonerations prior to this. But this is a really remarkable activity that took place under State Attorney
Melissa Nelson. It
would not have taken place.
Yeah.
This letter would have gone nowhere. Myers wrote a letter, 4-page letter to Melissa Nelson. That letter would probably have hit the floor someplace and it would never have happened.
Yeah. Kudos to Melissa Nelson, State Attorney Nelson, and her team for setting up this unit so that they can review cases like this. And I'm sure, as I said, there will be other ones. Lisa Gruber, we're getting tweets asking if the men will be compensated. Myers might get compensated from the state. His award could be capped at $2 million. Williams had prior felony convictions, so he cannot receive any compensation under the law, despite wrongfully spending more than 40 years in prison.
Right. And really, to put a fine point on this, and in some cases that are vacated, it's because new information came to light or, you know, new technology, whatever DNA allows us to look at information differently. But this was a case where existing information, as Fred and Charles have said, was not looked at. And, you know, the ballistics report existed, was not looked at. The alibi statements were not introduced into court. But adding insult to injury in this case, they were originally tried as death penalty cases. And they resulted in mistrials. They were retried, and the juries recommended life in prison. In the case of the older gentleman, Clifford Williams, the judge went ahead and recommended the death penalty. And the Florida State Supreme Court overturned that 4 years later. But this, as bad as this is, it could have been a lot worse because of the death penalty based on just an eyewitness statement.
The Innocence Project has freed quite a few inmates across the country that had been sitting on death row. They've exonerated people in 37 states. The Innocence Project was founded in 1992. Often they use DNA evidence to prove that people that have been wrongfully convicted need to be freed, that they were in many cases railroaded by the system. They've really established a new blueprint for science-based criminal justice reform, Steve. And we see this in case after case around the country. Their work can't be overstated. They've changed a lot of lives. So I just want to make a mention of them in this as well.
There's no question. Their part in this is very, very important. But here really we needed a local effort to simply say that we are going to have in Jacksonville someone who goes back and reevaluates cases here. Mm-hmm. And that provided the vehicle for moving forward. Yes. On this.
Yeah, I think this also provides an opportunity for us to, you know, to really legitimize taking a second look at our criminal justice system. A lot of people think that when you say criminal justice reform, you're talking about making it softer on crime, getting softer on crime. That's not the case. This proves that there are people in the system who don't belong there, and we should be. As a country, we should be willing to take a closer look at how we treat our criminal justice system and the people who are currently in the system and how they make their way through. Not just from arresting, but from prosecutions and incarcerations as well. So this proves that something needs to be done. Someone needs to step up and say, okay, we know there are other cases out there like this, and this is a reason enough for us to take a closer look at what's going on.
Amanda writes on our Facebook page, my fear is that this is not so unique to our city. What more will be done to investigate other convictions that may have been tainted by racial bias? Will there be any actions taken against those acting DAs and judges? What can we do to prevent these miscarriages of justice from happening again? And let's go to a few calls on this as well. If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable. As we talk about the top stories of the week, in a minute we'll talk about the Jacksonville Landing. This weekend is your last chance to go visit the Landing and take part in public events there. That's in a moment, but first a few of your calls. As two Jacksonville men are released from prison after more than 40 years incarcerated for crimes that the evidence shows they did not commit. 549-2937. Doran is on the west side. Doran, good morning. You're on the air.
Good morning. Good morning. I wanted to just solidify what I think all of your commentators, including you, Melissa, have alluded to this point, that it's probably unwise to support the death penalty because of the likelihood of this kind of error. And you pointed to the Innocence Project, which is having impact across the country. These errors are far too common for us to support the death penalty. So I wanted to just go ahead and say it. If you guys were maybe just trying to be a little bit more careful, I'll just come out and say it. And I also think this is why we got to examine clemency as well. Charles said it a few minutes ago. We really need to take another look at the entire criminal justice system. Thank you so much. Have a good weekend.
Thanks for that. Certainly people have strongly held opinions about the death penalty. The majority of Floridians still approve of it. Fred and Lisa, that said, as you see convictions overturned, including people sitting on death row in cases in most states around the country, those that oppose the death penalty point to this as a powerful argument.
Well, and there may be some more evidence coming soon. I think Melissa Nelson has had that Convictions and Integrity Unit has had 200 requests to look at cases, and I think they're looking at about 14 right now. Two other judicial districts in Florida have also started these. So there's a total of three judicial districts in Florida that have started these units. And so it'll be interesting to see what evidence comes out of that.
Yeah.
As with everything in our society, and particularly here in Florida, the legislature is, of course, the one who would be deciding this, along with the governor, if it were to come up. But it is about economics when it gets out of the local level. And the only thing the legislature is looking at right now that is of concern with them is the economics of housing so many prisoners that they can't They don't have enough money to continue to house the prisoners that they have. And in light of what happened in the hurricane in the Panhandle, having to shift all of those prisoners around the state to other prisons who are already overcrowded, that's what they're looking at, is the economics of it. Less are they concerned with the fairness of the sentences. And that's what we've got. We will have to get past here. And unless the legislators hear something from their local districts, folks, nothing's going to change.
Yeah, and Melissa,
nothing's going to change.
I think I mentioned earlier, well, before we came on the air, that I, you know, personally connected to someone who was wrongly convicted and exonerated in 1989, James Joseph Richardson. He was convicted in 1968,
here in
Jacksonville, and he served three, almost 4 years on death row. And before his death row conviction was vacated, and he was supposed to be serving out a life sentence. But he was exonerated in 1989, found out that he wasn't the person who committed the crime. Now, what if he would have been executed on death row?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, these are the types of things that we need to understand. If one person is going to be executed who didn't do it, that's reason enough for us to, take a closer look at how we implement the death penalty.
And keep in mind, every gubernatorial candidate on the conservative side takes that position: I support the death penalty. I support the death penalty. We haven't elected a governor who hasn't supported the death penalty, I don't think, since Bob Graham. And that's where the buck stops at in terms of helping this move along. We are the ones who can make that decision, but we keep electing folks to office who are not going to do it.
Steve.
Fred's correct.
I just want to make sure we don't leave you out.
No. I think this is simply a case that is remarkable in part. I think something people should keep in mind is the cast of legal minds that were involved in this. This was not a one-off thing where you could say there were just bad lawyers and bad judges. Mm-hmm. This was a case where the prosecutor became the president of the Florida Bar eventually.
Hank Cox.
Is a very, very respected attorney. One of the defense attorneys became a judge and then became the city's general counsel. The judge in the case became the chief judge for the circuit. And that is a good cast of characters. This was
that got it wrong.
Yes, yeah. The results were wrong, and this suggests that you simply need to approach all of these cases humbly and see that it is possible for good people to get things very wrong.
If you're just tuning in, it's our Friday Media Roundtable here on 89.9 on this fine Friday as we talk about the biggest news headlines from the week and your calls. We'll go to them in just a moment at 549-2937. Give us a call right now because we're going to talk about something I think a lot of you want to weigh in on, the Jacksonville landing. Yeah, there's going to be one last bash for the landing this weekend. This after the city council voted Tuesday 15-1. To buy out the downtown property to the tune of more than $18 million. Now, tonight through Sunday marks the final public weekend of events at the landing before it closes. The city takes ownership of the property, and we assume it will face the wrecking ball to make way for something new. What will that new something be? What do you think should happen to that space? Give us a call, 549-2937. Lisa Gruba of Florida Field Notes, there's been a petition drive going around asking city officials to reconsider the rush to demolish the Jacksonville Landing. People have grown increasingly concerned about the demolishing of so many downtown buildings without a solid plan in place to see what could go in their wake. That said, the city has said they do have renderings and a plan set up for the landing, including, by and large, a park-like space,
right,
is what they envision for this. A cynic might point out that Metropolitan Park, which is much desired by Shad Khan and his development group to build something on, can't immediately be accessed because it's a public park. If the city were to turn the landing space into a park, they could swap that park space for the Metropolitan Park space and build on Metropolitan Park and develop it into hotels, condos, shops, and restaurants, or whatever ShotKam wants to put there. Is this a backdoor way to accomplish those goals by demolishing the landing and making it into a park?
That's what I have heard from people in the real estate industry. People have speculated that it's to swap and so that they can develop on Metropolitan Park. I've not heard anything about that by any city council members or by the city. There's been nothing that has been alluded to by that. All the city has said is that they are going to tear it down and at the very least put grass over it so that it's not just a dirt space. Then there's also been a rendering that shows an actual park, but it's not really clear that we'll go as far as to make an actual park out of it. The thing is that, the community has been very interested in having something done with the landing, but also questioning why it needs to be torn down. And in the various council meetings this last week, the city council members did express they were hearing a lot from the community. Joyce Morgan said it. Danny Becton said it. And in fact, Councilman Becton tried to introduce an amendment that would approve the buyout of the lease, approve the buyout of the current operator, but leave the landing standing. And basically, council members said, we can't do that because then that puts the city operating the landing and we're in no position to operate the landing. Mm-hmm. So that amendment was defeated.
Yeah, I think that what happens now is what people are most interested in because this has been happening awful fast. It wasn't more than just a little more than a month ago that all this, came to be. We just really found out about the settlement. The money moved through council, and people are kind of still scratching their heads about what's going to come next. And the sooner people find out what's going to happen next, the more comfortable they'll be. I think people agree that the landing wasn't the most desirable location downtown to hang out anymore. I think that was probably common knowledge, but they like to do things down there. That's one of the spaces that people like to see things happen. Mm-hmm. You remember the big flack about not having events for the jazz festival. People wanted to be in that space during the jazz festival for activities. So what comes next is the really big question. And how will you fulfill the wants of the community around the atmosphere that people would like to see there?
But the city hasn't ever repaired the docks since Hurricane Irma. So that was a pretty long dock space that was used by the St. John's River Taxi and by area boaters and was part of the draw for there. Well, they've never been repaired since Hurricane Irma. And so after that, the operator filed a suit against the city claiming that they weren't doing their job as part of the upkeep. And part of this buyout then is relieving the city of the liability for that suit.
This is one of those issues in which the public really doesn't have very much to do with it. It doesn't have downtown, unfortunately, doesn't have a voting constituency that you can depend upon. The DIA is supposed to be looking out for downtown, but basically they approve what developers bring to them and what the mayor will agree to. And this is a case in point. We got the landing, not because citizens demanded that we have a landing, but because the people in downtown, the mayor and the city council at the time said, let's have a landing. Let's bring Ross in here to put it here. And we got it. And as John Crescenbeny pointed out at the city council meeting this last week, I mean, he tried to put his Hickory Farms franchise down there, and it was the worst performing of all the franchises that he had after just 6 years. And the Rouse plan that was here originally in another city closed within 6 years of their developing the Rouse plan that we've modeled our landing after. This is totally in the hands of the mayor's office and the DIA. And there are some subplots like this land swap.
Right. I'm wondering if that's the subplot.
We won't know until the last minute.
Steve Patterson, our intrepid reporter, Steve Patterson from the Times Union. It's now all on you and your colleagues to run this down.
We are deeply cynical people. We'll be looking for some answer somewhere.
All right. Let's go to your calls, Jam Lines, about the future of the Jacksonville Landing. This weekend is your last chance to go there. A whole slate of events Friday through Sunday at the Landing, the last bash for that property before the city takes it over. And we assume it is demolished. 549-2937. Javon is on the line all the way from Tampa. Javon, good morning.
Good morning. And I grew up in Jacksonville, spent a lot of time at the Landing back in the late 90s, early 2000s. Just last night, I was in Ybor City, and, you know, it's got the great historic feel, and Jacksonville is making the same mistake it's made in decades past, where it tears down everything and builds up a bunch of stuff that then nobody wants to come and see anymore. So, and they're doing it very quickly, that, you know, the Landing is just going to become another green space. The problem with the Landing has never been what it looks like, but it's never had a compelling reason on a consistent basis for people to go, and that's not going to change. You know, get the University of North Florida and EWC and Duval County Schools to do some kind of working, learning, creative space, and give people a reason to be at the Landing, something that's unique and creative and whatnot, and people will come down there. But the city just likes to ignore things and then say, oh, well, it's not working, let's tear it down and sell it to somebody else. So it's, you know, it's disappointing, but, you know, Jacksonville has got to figure out its identity if it wants to keep the things that it likes.
Thanks for that, Javon. You know, if you go to our partner's website, the Jackson Mag, they have a front page story looking at this. If they knock down the Landing and then combine it with their parking lot, that's about 9 acres of land that could involve some form of public green space. And I'm quoting here, in hopes of not seeing another poorly designed and maintained public green space in downtown, here's a look at what a real urban park resembles and what it costs. And they list 10 examples around the country of urban park space that actually work well, that are models for what we could try to achieve everywhere from Baltimore to Greenville, South Carolina, to Savannah, Georgia, and many other examples. So I would just encourage people to take a look at that and see what else is happening around the country.
Yeah. Speaking of what's happening around the country, it's well documented that most of those Rouse projects have gone by the wayside. But Bayside has, when Miami has actually, you know, still thriving down there. And they pretty much had the same situation as we had here with the development. They built the arena next to it and created more shopping opportunities adjacent to it. So hopefully whatever the plan is there'll be more people designed into the area where there's some vibrant activity that can go along, because this is a featured part of downtown.
Stevie in Murray Hill. Hi, Stevie. Good morning. You're on the air.
Hey, good morning. I might be putting the cart before the horse about the Landing, but just kind of to piggyback on what you just talked about in the magazine about how they're showing other cities around the country and what they're able to do with their open spaces. I'm born and raised in Jacksonville. I haven't spent time at the Landing since I was maybe 14, and I'm almost 40. So I don't think that it's a place where most people think of to go and spend time. But I've traveled to a bunch of cities around this country, and the fact is that it has to be a combination of green space, retail, living, things like that. But I just wish that we could have something architecturally significant. Like, if the city could actually put it out there, you know, put the bid out there and say, hey, give us your best design, show us something that's, you know, ecologically sound and architecturally significant and beautiful, and that would draw people to the waterfront, which is our biggest resource that we make no use of. You know, could it incorporate a marina? Could that marina have a beautiful restaurant? Something that is going to bring people down there to spend their leisure time and their money. You know, not something that's just a park. A park's great, but who's going to maintain that park?
Absolutely, so, all right, Stevie. Thank you. Yeah, I think you're echoing the hopes of so many people. Thanks for that call. Lots of calls. April is on the south side. Hi, April. Go ahead. Okay, let's try her again. April, go ahead.
I just have some very exciting news for the Jacksonville art community. I've recently opened an art gallery called Home Street Gallery and Studios on 1451 Home Street. And I just want to kind of have a new experience for the artists, the art community in Jacksonville, kind of a Santa Fe kind of attitude. And I have some great artists that we are exhibiting. Enzo Torcoletti is a Jacksonville artist with St. Augustine. He's actually internationally known. He's a sculptor. Have Allison Watson, Pablo Rivera, Jeff Lukey. Who
and this is on the South Bank, right? You're on the South Bank?
Yes, ma'am. On the South Bank off of Hendricks and Prudential Drive. It's an old house that has been converted into a gallery in 1908. It was built. And it's an old Edwardian house.
And so are you making the argument then for adaptive reuse, like not tearing the building down on the landing site?
Repurposing, absolutely repurposing. It's a great location for people. I want to get younger people involved in art because it's a wonderful thing to just experience this. Not be political, just look at art and enjoy art. Just enjoy it.
Thanks, April.
It's a wonderful feeling. It makes you feel great.
Thank you, April. There's this petition going around saying, stop tearing down all these buildings. People that are angry about this are calling the mayor rebel because you drive around downtown, Steve Patterson, and you see a lot of rebel right now, and there's going to be more. And so now that's not to say that all of these buildings could have been adaptively reused, like the old courthouse and the old city hall annex. But there's so many things coming down now or in the pipeline to come down that it's the adaptive reuse urban core advocates are getting louder about this.
They are. But at the same time, there are also buildings that are downtown that people are unhappy with and they hang in there. I'm thinking of Berkman 2, which was never completed and has been sitting
empty
as this desolate wreck. And that's been there for better than a decade. And the city has a plan for repurposing that. And there are questions about the validity of what's being planned there. So I think there is simply room for question and second thought on almost any choice you make downtown.
And the question, the issue is still the same. Who are you going to complain to? Who are you complaining to? Who are you bringing your plan to? The plan has to either be accepted through the Downtown Investment Authority or it's going to be accepted through the mayor's office. You're not going to take it to a city councilman because they'd have nothing to do with it except for legislation. So the petitions need to be going somewhere and somebody needs to be there to accept it because the plan for the landing is already set in play.
Scott in Orange Park. Go ahead, Scott.
Hi. About 12 years back, I fought to save Fire Station 5. And what Fidelity did under Peyton was they traded a 100-year-old fire station. You know the one I'm talking about, the old yellow one. And what the city got in return was a little bit of park space and a retention pond that they have to take care of. And Fidelity got that property, and it's not even protected. It's 100 years old and not protected. Years back, they took the old fire station that was down by the courthouse and moved it down to Metro Park. I think what needs to be in place there is something that's interactive. Kayak launching, marina, green space, small shops, restaurants. Similar to what's in the South Bank, because when I came here in 89, Hemming Plaza still had Woolworth, and the landing was like one of the only places to go. Now that the city is starting to become vibrant, that needs to be a central hub for a lot of the events that happen in the city. So that's my take on it.
Thank you, Scott.
Thanks
for that.
There is, I think, one phrase that comes to mind that might be thought about here, which is riverfront activation. We heard a lot of talk about a year and a half ago about the great potential for the city's downtown through good use of the riverfront. Well, the landing and whatever happens to the landing now is a really, really good time to test that out.
Christopher is in Atlantic Beach. Christopher, what are your thoughts?
Well, for years I served a small church that got several preservation grants, and I was really exposed to that community. And I have a theory that we're willing to tear down anything our parents built, but if it predates that, then maybe they're good. And I'd like to advocate that the DuPont Center, which was the Hayden Burns Library, sat vacant for 10 years. And fortunately, our present mayor wasn't mayor, and they didn't tear it down. It finally was adaptive reuse. It was beautifully restored. And I think that we're so quick to tear everything down. And what we what preservationists will tell you is that we lose that thing that's unique to our community. If you tear everything down and build it just like every other community, then we're going to look like every town in the United States.
Thanks, Christopher. And, advocates of repurposing the landing building in some way have made the same argument. They've pointed out that these other festival marketplaces that went south in other cities weren't torn down. They were repurposed. And so that is the argument for not demolishing a functioning building, even if it's not commercially viable now, to not be so quick to just raise it before considering right. other ways the building could be repurposed or remodeled. Mm-hmm. The city, though, we had Councilman Bill Gulliford on the show yesterday. City council reps just they're not buying that argument. They don't see that argument.
Well, Councilman Cressenbeny did ask in the council meeting this week. He asked Brian Hughes, if there were proposals that came in, would they consider them? And Hugh said, yes, they would. What I would tell citizens, if they are truly interested in, some kind of proposal, they need to act now, sooner rather than later. The time frame on this is about 6 months. They expect to close on the deal in 45 days, and they expect the demolition to be within 6 months. So if people really do have ideas they would like to take to the city,
Now's the time.
Yeah.
And a quick update to what I said earlier. One last weekend of public events at the Landing this weekend, Friday through Sunday. But the property will stay open for at least several more months. But this is the last big sort of party weekend at the Jacksonville Landing. So if you want to stop by there, this is the time to do it. Now, another story that caught our eye this week. A local flood working group is being criticized for not actually studying areas that flood. It's called the Adaptation Action Area Working Group, sort of an unwieldy name for a city task force that's looking at the effects of flooding on coastal areas. But of course, it was the downtown neighborhoods that line the St. Johns River that saw historic flooding during and after Hurricane Irma. That was the city's worst flooding in more than a century. Now, as the Times Union and others have reported, this working group is using a coastal hazards map that was created using incomplete assumptions. So they're working under the assumptions that don't capture the scope of inland flooding for those neighborhoods along the river. And so, according to the TU, Steve Patterson, I'm quoting here, the city's best chance at a real study of sea level rise and storm surge hazards along our massive coastal and inland shorelines is on track to be fatally flawed. Can this group change course and take into account the possibility that our inland flooding could happen again if all the storm patterns line up the way they did during Hurricane Irma? And do we need to be better prepared for that in the future is the question.
And certainly the city needs to be better prepared, whether it's going to be as a consequence of what this working group does, that we're just going to have to wait and see. The coastal hazard area that was established was originally sort of a compromise that came from trying to map an area that the regional council could feel comfortable saying there are sea level elevation issues here, and the working group was told this week about the limitations of their plan of their study area. Have said that they are open to considering
other areas, this other area, yeah.
But they haven't talked about new boundaries yet. Mm.
Yeah, it sounds like the working group is building the bicycle while they're riding it, and they're still trying to understand what you know, the scope of all the work that they need to undertake here. And also what we know about political priorities is that when people have their mind made up about projects that they want to do, those projects usually get done if they have the political will to get them done. And underneath all of this is the progress that's going on with the port and with the St. John's River. And so who wants to interrupt that, right, with new rules and regulations? What'll probably end up happening is that, you know, you'll find ways to mitigate that down the road if it becomes a significant problem.
Yeah. Now, Mr. Olson, who you mentioned, Steve, who's on the committee, points out that with 2 feet of sea level rise expected in a few decades, it is theoretically possible that many of our existing city drainage systems in older neighborhoods will fail to operate for much of the year.
Correct. And Olson.
Hello.
Olson brings up a really important point in this. He told the working group to look at projections for river level change, and he said that with that, you should calculate in once river deepening is done, an additional couple inches of river height. A couple inches is not a huge sounding amount, but it has a huge impact on your drainage system. And so it just quickly elevates the number of days per year that your drainage is not going to work.
Josh writes on our Facebook page, "This unfortunate oversight of the Sea Level Rise Committee demonstrates how important it is for vulnerable communities to have a seat at the table. It is a terrible misstep by the mayor's office that no citizens were included in this committee, which is what best practices in environmental decision making call for." People from the communities that are most vulnerable, Lisa, like Ken Knight Drive and other places around town,
exactly.
They come to mind. So, yeah.
Exactly. I don't think that the community has heard a lot about these groups yet. And actually, there are 2 groups that the city set up. And they both have really long names. But it looked to me like one of them was for infrastructure around the St. John's River, and then this other one that we're talking about, what they call the AAA working group, was for coastal flooding. But I'll say the one thing I think the city did right is instead of setting this up as a city council subcommittee where you have to get all council members up to speed on the issue, and I do think we have very mm-hmm. competent council members.
They had people with some expertise on this committee.
So it was an sure. engineer that flagged it.
Yes, and thank you for pointing that out. Thank you, Lisa, Charles, Steve, and Fred. Thanks for being here, guys.
Thank you.
Now, here's how you can support WJCT.
The way you support us is you give us a quick call at 353-9528 to show your support for First Coast Connect. What an excellent program this morning. Lots of phone calls. It's our interactive program that allows you to ask the newsmakers and important people in this community the questions that mean something to you. I'm David Luckin here with David McGowan, our president and CEO, and we are here because we're wrapping up the pledge drive.
That's right, and we've had lots of great phone calls into the media roundtable on First Coast Connect this morning, and now we need to make a different phone line ring, and that's 904-353-9528. You know, every time I listen to this program, David, and I try to listen to the media roundtable every Friday, I'm impressed not only, of course, with our guests that we have in the studio, but with our audience.
Always.
The insight, the intelligence, yep. the great questions, whether it's holding our city officials to account or voicing their well-informed opinions, it's such an invaluable forum for this community to have. Please support it now. This is your last chance this time. 904-353-9528.
Or, of course, you can go online at wjct.org and look for the Radio Uninterrupted. So call us now, 353-9528. We thank everyone for calling, and now it's your turn, 353-9528.
Understand their home loan options and make informed choices. Five-star, we never forget that it's your money. Information available at 777-6000 or vistarcu.org.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm.
I'm Wayne Hogan. A mini stroke, or TIA, happens when blood is briefly blocked from the brain. It often warns of a looming stroke and requires immediate medical attention.
Learn more at waynehogan.law.
Who's been cleared of wrongdoing? President Trump or Jussie Smollett?
He abused the city of Chicago. They better get their story straight.
Also, Oklahoma forces the makers of OxyContin to pay a heavy price. 2 senators advance plans for paid family leave, and why was Ronald Reagan seen riding a velociraptor? The Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
Today at 10 on 89.9 WJCT.
Did you know that calculus was key to solving an HIV treatment mystery? I'm Ira Flatow. National Poetry Month is right around the corner. We'll talk to the U.S. Poet Laureate and a poet physician about where science fits into their craft. All on Science Friday from WNYC Studios.
Friday at 3 on 89.9 WJCT. The Alhambra Theater and Dining features Big the Musical, an awkward kid's wish to become big is granted. Soon he realizes adulthood ain't all it's cracked up to be and wants to be a kid again. Opens March 27th. Tickets at alhambrajacks.com.
Wayne Hogan of the Terrell Hogan Law Firm. Malignant mesothelioma. Asbestos dust causes this cancer. Learn more from board-certified civil trial specialist Wayne Hogan at waynehogan.law.
Finally, this hour, it's a chance to enjoy a brush with nature this weekend at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens. It is just an incredible sight as artists from the First Coast Plein Air Painters create and sell their artwork in this beautiful park-like setting. And plein air means in the open air. So when you come out to the Arboretum, you'll see beautiful artwork being created. It is really a special event, and it's free, although donations to the Arboretum are, of course, encouraged. If you've never been to the Jacksonville Arboretum, this weekend is the perfect time to come check it out. It is just an incredible gem in the city. Here with more St. Augustine artist Gail Beveridge. She's the event committee member, and Ron Whittington, the board chair of the Jacksonville Arboretum. Good morning to you both.
Good morning.
Thanks for being with us. Ron, let's start with you. This is just an incredible event every year that the Arboretum does, and I've had the opportunity to go a couple of times. It's just beautiful. Tell us what all is going to be happening.
Well, we actually started in 2011, and we went on hiatus for a while, but we pulled it back, did it last year, did really, really well. We had we have about a couple dozen artists come out. And basically, they're painting. They do paint outs up until this event. So they've already been out at the Arboretum. But what's beautiful about this weekend is the weather's supposed to be great. Mm-hmm. They'll be painting everywhere, and everything is in bloom. So it's just a beautiful location. The weather's going to be wonderful. There are kids' activities from noon to three every day. We're going to have food trucks out there. And if you've never been, like you said, if you've never been to the Arboretum, this weekend's going to be a fabulous weekend to come out.
It's going to be perfect spring weather. And it's amazing to me when you go to the Arboretum, you really have, you feel as though you're far, far away from city life, but it's in the heart of the city.
Right. This, for people that don't know, it's right at the corner of 295 and Monument Boulevard. And this used to be a mining area. And then the mining folks left, and it was sat idle for a while. And long story short is the city leases it to the Arboretum, which is a nonprofit. And we celebrated our 10th year, open to the public last year, open to the public in 2008. Everything you see out there has been done by volunteers. There's 3 miles of trails. There's a lake loop. And like I said, just hiking, and just if you want to get back to nature, it's just mm-hmm. a wonderful way to do it.
Now, Marilyn Antrim, the plein air tradition was established in France in the mid-19th century. The idea of artists painting outside and painting what they saw, the beauty of nature, this continues that tradition.
Oh, absolutely. We have a whole group that dedicated to this in Northeast Florida, First Coast Plein Air Painters. And we have quite a following. I'm actually the treasurer of the group, and we have about 90 members and growing all the time. In fact, we got a lot of members after the last brush with nature. Mm-hmm. People came out and said, wonderful, how can we do this?
Sure.
Yeah.
So people can come, enjoy the Arboretum, enjoy the paintings, and they can buy the artwork too.
Right. We host the event for them, but we have a split, basically.
Yeah.
And a lot of beautiful stuff and all types, right? I mean, we have all types of...
Yes. There will be watercolors, oils, pastels. Everything is framed, ready to hang. So it's very easy for somebody to buy something, put it, go home, put it on the wall.
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Get out and enjoy a brush with nature Saturday and Sunday at the Jacksonville Arboretum and Gardens. This is a joint project of the Arboretum and the First Coast Plein Air Painters. Saturday, 9 to 5, and Sunday, also 9 to 5.
Right.
Beautiful weather expected, and it truly is a delight. I really recommend that you go and check this out. If you've never been and you need a little more information, just go to jacksonvillearboretum.org. Ron Whittington, board chair of the Arboretum, Marilyn Antrim with the First Coast Plein Air Painters. Thanks for bringing all this beauty to us every year. Have fun.
Thank you. We will. It's fun.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys. That's our show. Our producer is the scintillating Heather Schatz. The serene and majestic Michelle Corum is our director. 1A is up next. We'll be back Monday with Mark Woods of the Times Union as we go on one of his walks through Jacksonville. Right now, here's how you can support WJCT. Keep listening.
Oh, and that's so simple. Thank you, Melissa. 353-9528 is a number you should call right now to support First Coast Connect. What a great program today. As usual, full of information you can use and a little something to do on the weekends at the end there to make it a great weekend. I'm David Luckin, host of the Electro Lounge, here with Jessica Palumbo, our news director, and we want you to call us right now.
Good morning. You can call us at 353-9528 or WJCT.org and make your gift on this last day of the Spring Pledge Drive. We have quite a ways to go today, David.
Oh, only 40,000.
Only $40,000.
We can do it. A few $10,000 checks and we are on the way with your help. Okay, $100 checks.
$5, $10, anything you can do. WJCT appreciates any help it can get today at 353-9528 or WJCT.org.
And we thank you so much for your pledge.
Support for First Coast Connect is provided by Baptist Health and the North Florida TPO.